Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, our guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems than the science and politics of compassion. What brain scans and humanitarian campaigns are telling us about the human condition. While many in the West decry the politics of the former Soviet Union countries as corrupt and anti-democratic, our next guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism, and the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. Welcome, Henry Hale. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Your new book, Patronal Politics, you've essentially proposed this kind of new way of understanding events in the world that we have generally, in academia especially, called democratization, rising authoritarianism, or revolution. You think it's really actually part of a longer pattern. What are you getting at?
Yes, I think the general idea is that in countries where you have high levels of corruption, low rule of law, where so much of politics, as well, for that matter, as many other aspects of life, is about personal connections, who you know, that sort of thing, politics tends to work differently than it does in the West, for example. And I think that has big implications for the trajectories of countries in terms of their regime type and where they're going and patterns of politics. And so one of the broader conclusions is that when you have this sort of social environment where everything really depends on who you know and the personal connections and pressures that are put on individuals to vote a particular way, through these personal connections or rewards that might be doled out on an individual basis, what you tend to get is a kind of cycling in politics. And so you get situations where when personal connections are important to power in order to have any resources or to have protection from others who might threaten you, there tends to be a rally around the leader type effect that tends to facilitate people who want to establish a more authoritarian form of rule, who want to quash their opponents. But at the same time, these sorts of systems, which might be compared to a giant political machine of the Boss Tweed variety, are vulnerable to, in particular, succession crises. So when people start thinking that this leader, this big patron, might be on his or her way out, then kind of all hell breaks loose. People start thinking about the future, trying to identify who the next patron will be, and trying to get on that person's side, or trying to become that person, or trying to prevent your rival from becoming that person. And so that leads to a breakdown. That's where I think you see a lot of the major revolutions in countries like this. So I focus on the former Soviet world. So we have the color revolutions that were largely described in media as being the products primarily of mass uprisings and democratic yearnings in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, Rose Revolution in Georgia, Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan. But I think these actually have much more to do with succession politics at the top. It opens up space for popular opinion to get expressed through these protests. And then the succession process gets played out. You get a new leader. But then almost inevitably, you start getting the same kind of reconsolidation of a more authoritarian system as all these people try to seek out their own personal connections with the people who have power and who have access to resources, because you can't rely on rule of law or independent courts to protect your interests. So you have to have this personal connection. And so the result is then a return back to more authoritarian rule until you have the next wave of the next succession crisis, which then tends to lead to more tensions. And I think the main way, in the short run at least, that these leaders in these countries can avoid this sort of cycling is to try and just maintain a high degree of popular support by trying to provide things that people genuinely want. When that tends to be the case, it reduces the fragmentation effect and gives leaders more control over the succession process. But even so, succession is very fraught with risk for these leaders. So I think that's it in a nutshell in terms of how I think what I think the core nature of many societies in the world, in particular in the former Soviet bloc, is, and some of the implications for how politics works and how we might understand it.
I wondered if, in fact, we're seeing a sort of continuum of patronal politics rather than one being, absolutely patronal politics and another being not so much, like you said, Western societies, because some of those characteristics that you described, and you mentioned Boss Tweed, but some of them are still to some degree present in, say, U.S. politics. Who really matters. The role of money really matters. Personal favors for donors does occur. So would you put this on a spectrum across the world, or would you say one is distinct from the other system?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not a situation where you have some societies that are completely patronalistic, which is the term I use to describe these societies that have the low rule of law, high corruption, strong role for personal connections, and societies that are non-patronalistic. I use these concepts more as kind of ideal types in the sense that Max Weber described, sort of simplifications that illustrate a certain truth, even though no country is perfectly adherent to the type. So in this particular case, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly I'm at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I can see up close exactly how personal connections matter a lot in this town. But I think there are more generally some societies in which they just matter much, much more than they do in others, and matter to such a degree that they really overwhelm the presence of any kind of impartiality that might be present in, say, the court system or the rule of law. I would say that I think this situation where rulers rule by personal connections and people get things done through personal connections, you can think about it as the most natural way for government to be formed, going back to the original human communities where everybody did know each other. And then as societies expanded, governments expanded, that was the natural way for those rulers to start expanding their influence, was to work through people they knew, to kind of govern by, even when societies got too big for them to know everybody, they'd appoint their own personal representatives who would know the local people to rule themselves. And so I think the exceptions in world history have largely been those countries that have managed to some degree, escape this. So, that would be, Western countries in particular. Some Asian countries now have made some progress in that regard. But again, none of them have completely escaped it. Again, in Washington, D.C., I mean, we still have political machines in many parts of the United States. So this is not a completely either-or structure. But what I would suspect is that the countries where this matters the most, that are the most patronalistic, you'll start to see these most pronounced kinds of political swings and gyrations and real difficulties transitioning to a true liberal democracy with protection of rights. Whereas the other countries that have managed to escape this patronalism to at least some degree tend to have an easier time of it, and they've managed to make a political system that just works in a very different way. When people feel more secure through the rule of law and through court systems, that they don't have to rely just on personal connections to protect themselves or to get anything done.
Perhaps one of the other distinguishing factors, say, from the West in some ways, are coercion and direct benefit that happens in these patronal systems. Would you say that's true? And if so, how would you describe how it works in the patronal system?
Yes, absolutely. I think in societies, again, the ones that I have focused most on have been the former Soviet countries. The tendency is precisely to rule through these personal connections. And ideally, I think even for these rulers, I mean, they would like people to voluntarily go along with them and just to rely on rewards. But in practice, they tend to find it attractive as rulers to use some of these more coercive tools, right, which would be, the abuse of state organs for personal purposes. So it's very common in former Soviet states, as well as other parts of the world, of course, to for rulers to rely on their secret services, their police organs, to repress individuals, to collect information about individuals that can then be used for blackmail, arresting opponents. They can use control over budgetary resources to squeeze people that they don't like. People that are challenging the regime might suddenly find their donors subjected to tax inspections and fire inspections and all kinds of licensing problems that might hinder their ability to do business. So there's just a whole range of these kinds of activities that, again, involve these very personalized, targeted punishments as well as rewards for the loyal that help bolster the ruler's power. And I find that one of the interesting things about these societies is you often get people who come to power, sometimes through revolution, sometimes otherwise, who seem genuinely to want to change the system. But oftentimes what they find is they face a lot of opposition, partly just because any leader is going to have some sort of opposition to whatever they're trying to do. They don't tend to like this opposition, so it just becomes too tempting to use these sorts of powers. I mean, I think of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia, who was Western educated, had a degree from Columbia, came to power in Georgia, topped the Rose Revolution. So I think he, like many other leaders, found it more attractive to try and use some of these powers for good, for the sake of good reforms, in his view, than to forego them. But the result is that using them, they kind of generate their own reality and reconstitute some of these bad practices that then make a country more closed and a more authoritarian place. So after coming to power, he was able to reduce corruption in some areas, a truly dramatic reform of the police, the traffic police system in particular, which was notorious for bribe-taking, now is almost entirely clean. It's just a striking a reform that even his enemies, politically and otherwise, acknowledge. But at the same time, within a couple of years of the revolution, he found himself taking control over opposition media, ordering police to crack down a few years after the Rose Revolution on a massive opposition protest, and otherwise putting the squeeze on opposition increasingly. So it just became a much more closed place than it had been after the revolution. And I think that's symptomatic. I think there are many other examples that one could find of rulers just even ones that want to do good things, want to create democracy, want to reduce corruption, just find these patronalistic levers of power too useful or too attractive in their context, where everybody expects that these levers will be used anyway, too attractive to forego.
You mentioned that it's expectation that drives this, because everybody expects this.
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think it's, in societies, I mean, that's part of the problem, part of the reason why patronal politics, as I've called it in the book, is so persistent over time. And I think that is because if everybody is engaging in this kind of activity, right, if everybody thinks that in reality it's more about who you know than about who's right and or wrong, say, before the law, you don't expect the law to be impartially enforced, then there's just a very strong temptation and even a moral argument that people can make that they have to play by those same rules. Because if you're the only person that tries to behave honestly and everybody else doesn't, odds are good it's not going to be very good for you. And that may be okay for you personally, right? If you're willing to, be the odd person out. But what if it also affects your family? If you're the person unable to, bring home the bacon, right? If you have people who depend on you, and the only way to get something done that would help you, provide good things, is to go through these personal connections and maybe pay a bribe to, get something done. Then people generally tend to find that they have to do it. And so when everybody expects everybody else to do it, it makes their own individual decision to do it much easier, whereas it could change entirely if they expected that everybody was going to play by a different set of rules. And I think that's one of the great achievements of Western societies, is that it's been accomplished that most people expect other people not to blatantly subvert the law. And when people do that, you know, which they do continue to try, right? We still have corruption cases. You know, there's a widespread feeling that, you know, risk that people might be caught, or that this is just morally wrong. So there's enough of this expectation that this is not going to succeed that the behavior often gets caught and actually punished.
Let's turn to elections. I loved how you said this in the first part of the book. Elections are civil wars fought by nonviolent means. The opposite of what other political scientists have said about politics.
Right.
How is this the case?
Well, I think on one hand, we tend to think, especially in Western societies, of democracy sort of as what in the American context we think of as the New England town meeting, where we have citizens coming together and voicing different views, and then the broader public decides one way or other. You know, whereas in fact, I think in a lot of history, including much of the history of the United States, you know, what we've seen is that elections are the arena not simply for a hashing out of views, but for a competition of different political forces, because we don't have especially when you get a society that's more than just, again, a small town where everybody can know each other and actually hear each other's views, somehow all the views that exist in society have to get aggregated and hashed out, and it's impossible for everybody's ideas to get heard. And so then which ideas do get heard and which don't? Well, that's a situation that involves resources and power. Who can get their ideas onto the agenda, to get their ideas voted on, get their ideas heard by the population? And then you have the situation where in order to decide, what matters really is a turnout issue. How can you get your voters to the ballot box? Even in Western societies, right, that's an issue, and it's a situation that makes the administrative apparatus very important. Parties in the United States that can mobilize turnout, right, that can provide the buses and have the call centers to, you know, mobilize their supporters or physically bring them to the polls matters a lot. But in paternalistic societies, this just the paternalistic power aspect of it just becomes much more important, and it just becomes a much more organized battle that starts to blend over into the coercive or even sometimes violent. And so I think that's why, you know, if civil war is kind of the most violent way of resolving a political conflict within a country, completely devoid of rational debate over issues, elections are sort of the most peaceful way. In paternalistic societies, again, where I think you know, rule of law is largely it's not completely absent, but it's not reliable. You start getting these battles, which are both the battles for hearts and minds, but they're also very much a battle of political machines, which means trying to suppress other voices, trying to project your own voice. And for the strongest political machines, of course, they can pretty much squelch other voices. And in the most extreme cases, actually force the voters out, really. So you're just falsifying results. But I think what's interesting is you still, even in those societies where it's not a complete dictatorship or a monarchy, what formally decides the result of the battle is that you have to get an official election result somehow. And even a completely falsified election result is not easy to achieve. It's something that has to be mobilized. You have to have a huge administrative apparatus that's capable of organizing it, suppressing popular opposition, manipulating the party system in ways that you know, is going to facilitate that. And so even that completely engineered election is a kind of Herculean administrative defeat that kind of resembles the movement of a large army. to try and achieve its goals. And so they might not have to fire on the opposition side. They might not have to mow them down in organized battles. But there is that coercive element there. So that would be another case where I think there is sort of a continuum in the level of coercion that's involved in the electoral process. And many of the countries of the world are kind of in that area in between, that kind of some scholars have called it a gray area or a kind of twilight zone where, you do have some battle for real ideas, but a lot of the battle is a battle of these political machines.
You also wrote about a formal versus an informal kind of politics. How do you distinguish this informal aspect?
Well, when you talk about formal politics, I mean, formal politics is generally, the politics that are completely according to the way that laws appear on paper, the ways that they're formalized in legislation, if all law is perfectly obeyed. Informal politics is sort of the politics of the wink, of the mutual understanding that's concluded, and sometimes these unwritten rules, these informal rules, can be very developed and elaborate. Like mafia groups are a classic example of kind of informal politics governing them, right? I mean, there's a clear hierarchical structure. Everybody understands how it works, or if you don't understand, you're eliminated pretty quickly, or you're brought into line. But none of that is actually written down. And so informal politics then, I think, is this kind of whole realm of politics that it works through these types of understandings. And so, in most countries, highly patronalistic countries, again, like the former Soviet Union, you have some role for formal politics. I mean, there are laws that are passed, laws that are enforced by the police. But then so much of politics occurs off the books, so much that you can't even really understand how politics works if you don't understand the informal aspects, the unwritten rules of the game, who needs to be acknowledged when, what kinds of resources the different powers have, right? So, oligarchs, for example, these big these politically active business people, right? They can control massive corporate conglomerates. They have a very explicit political role in systems, for example, like Vladimir Putin. So, they're not in the government. They have no formal constitutional role, but they understand that in order to keep their business opportunities alive, they have to not run afoul, at a minimum, of Putin and perhaps better please him. And so they serve these roles of providing money and channeling money to forces that tend to work for the Kremlin, stifling financial opportunities of parties or individuals who might be, doing things that the government doesn't like. And so, again, that's an example of an informal political role, but this very important for understanding how the larger political system works. So, Russia's political system is not like they just passed a law saying all opposition are banned. There's no such law. But there's an informal understanding that those groups that do openly challenge the Kremlin are going to find going to have a very hard time, in business, raising money, doing almost anything that they want to do. At least if these opposition forces are serious enough, the Kremlin is concerned about them. If they're just small fry, they may just leave them alone.
We will continue next week with Henry Hale. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Patronal Politics. When we come back, the science and the politics of compassion. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Does compassion and compassion training change our physiology and our sociology for the better? Three experts join us. James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. Welcome to the three of you, and thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. I'd like to begin with, what exactly is compassion? James Doty, let's begin with you. What's the scientific basis for compassion?
Let me just preface this by saying that sometimes when this comes up, you could get multiple answers from different people. And in fact, there was a person who said scientists actually do not agree on what the definition of compassion is. And I will tell you that in a general sense, and one that I think is agreed upon by a number of people, it is the recognition of the suffering of another with a desire to alleviate that suffering. And that's not necessarily to say that one has the ability to or is able to or in fact act. It is simply that they have a desire to alleviate that suffering.
Paul Gilbert?
Yeah, I think what Jim's point is exactly what we would see as compassion, this sensitivity to suffering itself and others with a commitment to try and alleviate and to prevent it. In the model that we use, this has two psychologies to it. Firstly is the psychology of willingness to engage with suffering, to turn towards it, to try to understand it, as opposed to dissociating, avoiding, or, you know, turning your back on it. And the second psychology is acquiring the wisdom to be able to do something about it. So an example we give is of compassion is that, you know, if you see somebody fall into a fast-flowing river and you think, gosh, you know, I must jump in and save them. So the first psychology is the intention to engage and put yourself forward. But then mid-jump, you suddenly realize, oh, gosh, I can't swim. Unfortunately, there isn't any action behind it to actually alleviate suffering and so forth. And in the Buddhist traditions, there's that we learn to become enlightened in order to enlighten others. In other words, we spend a lot of time applying ourselves to learn how to alleviate suffering. So intentionality is important, but like with being a doctor or a surgeon, as Jim is, you then have to put in the work to learn what to do. So full compassion is this process of being orientated to suffering, to pay attention to it, to become aware of it, to try to understand it, the nature of it, the causes of it, and then to apply how to create within oneself the wisdom to know what to do. And finally, in our model, we have three. The flow of compassion is the compassion that you feel for other people, the compassion that you are open to from other people, so you're open to the helpfulness of others, and there's also self-compassion. So that's how we would see it in the therapy model that we use.
Ian Wilkinson, would you agree?
I think both the definitions offered so far are helpful, but it might also be useful to add into this that certainly in philosophy and social science, compassion is often defined in contrast to other related emotions such as pity, sympathy, empathy. And in relation to those other three, compassion tends to be identified as a stronger identification and concern for the suffering others than perhaps would be taking place in pity, sympathy, or empathy. These distinctions just work analytically, and it's important to add as well that we're actually talking about a very complex feeling, a moral feeling, and when it comes to discerning precisely what's taking place, it always invites, you know, contested definitions, it always invites moral debate, but put set simply, you know, a feeling for the suffering of others and married to a concern to alleviate their suffering, that's a very good place to start.
I think it was Paul who just said also compassion for the self. So it is perhaps not just for others. Would that be accurate?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think a number of people would argue that, first of all, especially in Western society, we have a tendency to be hypercritical to ourselves. And that can, and in fact does, have a very negative effect because it creates a self-image that in and of itself is negative. And then as a result, it's much more difficult to, number one, recognize the suffering of others, but also, in fact, to alleviate suffering. So self-compassion certainly is a critical component in the context of understanding one's ability to give compassion and recognize that to maximally do so, that has to be a component.
Let's talk about the physiology or the biology of what we're discovering through the sciences. James Doty, you're heading up this institute, and it seems that the researchers affiliated with your center have been using MRIs to study the impacts of, say, compassion training to become more compassionate. What is it finding?
Maybe we back up just a little bit to say, what is it about compassion that, if you look at an evolutionary construct, what is it about compassion that is so important? And if you look at the development of humans, multiple things happened to make us human, if you will. One is, of course, theory of mind, the ability to see that you have independent thoughts of others or vice versa. The other is the development of abstract thinking, and then, of course, complex language. And those components of our evolution required a significant increase in cortex size, but it also resulted in a requirement that the infant be cared for outside of the womb for up to 15, 20 years, in my case, apparently 30 years. But we have to take care of our children. And unless there was a very strong bonding mechanism to the family or the mother or the parents, you would not care for your child because it takes significant energy to do so. So for our species to survive as humans with those components, it requires that we care for our young, and it takes a long time for them to develop the characteristics of humans. So that is, if you will, inherent within our DNA. The other aspect is, as we then evolved to the hunter-gatherer tribe, a couple other things had to happen. One is, in addition to this ability to recognize that your child is suffering and to intervene to stop that suffering, to make sure they're not hurt, to make sure they're going to survive, this then translated to these small hunter-gatherer groups. Because if you did not have the ability to gauge emotion or suffering, it would potentially put the entire group at risk. And that's why we have evolved incredible mechanisms to recognize, as an example, microfacial expressions to indicate suffering or emotion. And that's why we also have these connections to those that are within our group to alleviate their suffering, because from an evolutionary perspective, that is critically important to our survival. So then to take it, though, a little bit further along in terms of the physiology, well, we know that to survive, we also have to reproduce and we also have to eat. And, of course, what happens when those two events occur is that this is very strongly connected to pleasure centers. And, in fact, we also know that because compassion or caring for the other is such a critical component, those pathways in the brain that are associated with pleasure also increase their metabolism in the context of compassion as well. So it just shows you how critically important this behavior or component is to human survival.
Paul Gilbert, what would you add to this?
The interesting thing is that mammals in particular respond to the distress calls of their young. And the ability to be sensitive to a distress call and respond to it may be one of the early precursors for compassion. The other aspect, which is really interesting, is the fact that in the evolution of the attachment system, which is what Jim was talking about, the parent is able to regulate the physiology of the infant such that the parent can calm the infant down. So when the infant's distressed, the infant can go to the parent or the parent goes to the infant, and through bodily contact, touching, and various other signals, actually stimulates oxytocin and the parasympathetic system. Now, these, we think, are quite important in the experience of compassion from others, because that's one of the things I'm interested in, is how people respond to receiving compassion from others. And we think that that system is extremely important in the ability to receive compassion. So when we are experiencing compassion and when we're being self-compassionate, we are actually engaging in a sort of calming process. So the affiliative system and the attachment system, which gives rise to compassion, the ability to be sensitive to distress, then you get an input, caring input from another, and then your distress settles down. We think that's a very important process for the regulation of distress, and in humans is fundamental. You know, when we're distressed, we nearly always turn to others who we think care and love us to find a source of comfort and support. So Jim says, you know, we're biologically set up to be regulated through relationships, and in particular through caring relationships. And the other important thing about caring relationships is that caring relationships give us courage. So if you think of something that's difficult to do, you've got a frightening hospital appointment to go to, or you're going through a painful divorce, if you turn to your friends, what you want your friends to do is not to encourage you to avoid the hospital appointment or don't go through the divorce, it's too painful, but what you want your friends to do is to encourage you and support you so that you can go through what is painful to you. You feel supported by them. They will encourage you to face what you need to face. So these mechanisms that Jim is talking about in terms of the way in which the caring system works are very fundamental, because if we don't have people around us who can understand our distress and respond to that distress and therefore encourage us to face things that we need to face, life would become very, very tough. And of course, the people who I work with who are depressed, that's exactly the problem that they often have, is they don't really have much caring in their environment.
Let's widen this now and take a look at culture and politics. When people respond to others, say in a humanitarian crisis, Ian Wilkinson, this is an area that you've been looking at. How does this work in terms of across the globe, humanitarian issues, images being seen from one country to another?
Well, before I begin to try and address that issue, I just want to say where I'm coming from is from the direction of sociology and social history. And so I take the view that whatever biological disposition we might have towards compassion is also is subject to processes of social conditioning and cultural nurture. And from that perspective, one of the interesting things about modern humanitarianism is its relative novelty. It seems that in modern times, we have acquired a compassionate concern for distant strangers that was not present in earlier forms of human society. Now, understanding why that is the case, I think, involves us looking at lots of contributing factors. If some hold that it's related to the ways in which we are emotionally regulated in modern times, and the argument here would be that where we're more controlled in our emotional lives and are more concerned to display traits of civilized constraint, this also has a knock-on effect in making us more alarmed by the sight of the suffering of others and more concerned to alleviate that, remove it from our sight. That's one argument. Another argument is connected to the growth in our capacity to visualize the suffering of others, and it's possible to trace a history of humanitarianism and its development into organized forms of politics as growing hand in hand with the development of our technological capacity to render visible the suffering of others. But of course, that also engenders lots of other debates about how the visibility of suffering might also erode capacity to feel for others just by the ubiquity of the imagery and its familiarity. We might have sometimes respond to this with, you know, feeling less for what we see. It becomes more mundane. So this is a very, very complicated set of phenomena that we're trying to explain here.
One of the things that I saw in your book, Ian Wilkinson, was about this idea of compassion fatigue, which is, I think, what you're talking about, whether or not people get fatigued from so much suffering in the world and wanting to escape it because it sort of hurts.
I think when it comes to understanding compassion fatigue, it's important to think about this at different levels. For example, if the very notion of compassion fatigue incorporates the assumption that there's a time and place where people are not tired by their compassion, they're not fatigued by it. Historically speaking, I don't think we can look back to a time where there is this kind of untired, unfatigued place of compassion. Historically speaking, I think there's a more concerted, large-scale, organized attempt to care for the suffering of people taking place now than there ever has been in human history. And the very fact that we worry about compassion fatigue might actually reveal the opposite, that we're actually more compassionate than we ever have been and are worried perhaps that there isn't enough of it. But at the same time, as I hold to that view, though, I think when you're looking at the health of people who are involved in serious and difficult care work, there, it might be right to talk of a form of fatigue that enters into that, possesses them through the strenuous effort of care. And so I think in the context of nursing is just one example, then it is a valid category for understanding an experience of burnout that some people have when they're dealing every day with difficult and trying circumstances of care for suffering.
What I'd like to do is now turn to people who have compassion, people who may not develop that kind of compassion, and the training of compassion. Paul Gilbert, I'd like to turn to you because of an introduction that I read in your edited volume where you talked about compassion in cruelty. How would you help us understand compassion versus cruelty and their development?
Well, that's exactly what Ian was saying. The interesting thing about humans is that we are multiples. What I mean by that is there are many versions of us that are possible. So, for example, if I had been kidnapped as a three-day-old baby into a violent drug gang and, you know, whizzed off to some foreign country and brought up as a violent gangster, this version of me wouldn't exist. A very different version of Paul Gilbert would exist. So what Ian was saying is absolutely right. Not only is it our values that change, but we now know that the environment in which we live influences our genetic expression. So the environment in which we grow has fundamental impacts on the kind of versions we become, how our brains mature, how our genes get expressed. The environment is absolutely crucial. And if you look back in history, I'm afraid humans have shown themselves to be potentially an extremely nasty species. Certainly in England, up until about 300-400 years ago, every major city had a torture chamber. Watching people being hung, drawing, and quartered was sort of a public entertainment. And, you know, the Roman games. And we can go on and on, you know, the Holocaust and so on and so on. So, you know, atrocities, what's going on in Syria right now. So the point is that, you know, although we have the potential to be most compassionate, we also have the potential to be extremely cruel. And not only can we be cruel to other people, but we can also be quite cruel to ourselves. So we have to understand compassion competes, as it were, with these other potential states of mind, these other potential selves, these which may well be partly socially created. So one of the points about compassion training is that compassion is certainly a potential, but in many of the traditions, you also have to cultivate it, because for some people, it's a more natural disposition, maybe because of genes or maybe because they come from loving backgrounds. But for other people, you do have to help people cultivate it. And that's where a lot of interest is now, is can you train people to cultivate states of mind that are conducive to compassion as opposed to conducive to greed or competitiveness or an interest in cruelty or watching sadistic movies or whatever it is. So recognizing that humans are multiple, there are many possible versions of us, there are many different states of mind. We can dissociate very easily. We can love our children in the morning and bomb somebody else's children in the afternoon. We're a very odd species in this regard. And therefore, the whole issue of cultivating, choosing, deciding, how should we educate our minds, both personally and at a social level? Because if we don't make decisions about how we're going to educate our minds, it's quite easy for us to become quite an unpleasant individual to ourselves and to others. Finally, taking up Ian's point, we are moving towards a recognition that we are all part of the same human group, and how can we extend compassion and kindness to others as opposed to, you know, the tribalism and the hatred that's also very easy to inflame within us.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the science and the politics of compassion. James Doty, this is one of the areas you're studying. Can you cultivate compassion? How do you do that? And what are the impacts?
I think all of those are important, and let me just make a couple comments. One is regarding Ian's comments. I think one of the reasons that we have much more interest in, if you will, the world stage and suffering that's going on is because we have much more access to that information. And to comment on the other aspect, which is the compassion fatigue aspect, if you see one child suffering, it's very easy to make a connection of sympathy and regard and desire to alleviate that suffering. And oftentimes, though, when you see a large number of people suffering and recognize that you have no ability to impact that, you are overwhelmed and therefore you withdraw because it's so painful and you're protecting your emotions. And certainly this concept of compassion fatigue or burnout within individuals, if you will, in the caring professions such as medicine, healthcare, even policing, and some of these other areas we are engaged in, if you will, protecting or caring for individuals in society. If you don't feel you have control or boundaries when you are seeing large numbers of people, it can become overwhelming, and essentially you sacrifice yourself trying to help these others when, of course, that doesn't work because if you're not at your best, you cannot care for people adequately. So that's certainly an issue, and it's one that's being addressed. The other aspect of compassion, which Paul alluded to, is this a more clear understanding of how environment or behavior, if you will, impacts the expression of certain genes in regard to the end effect of compassionate behavior. And also the reality that we know, looking at young people or children who've grown up without adequate attachment or bonding, if you will, nurturing or compassion, you can predict that they will have much more increased in the occurrence of disease or cancer, that the illnesses that they have will be more frequent and more severe and more prolonged, and that their longevity will be decreased. Conversely, when you look at people with good attachment, or if you will, who are compassionate, you see some very amazing physiologic effects, especially in the context of the ability, if you will, to train compassion. And what happens is that this has an effect on the autonomic nervous system in that there are two parts. One is the parasympathetic and one is the sympathetic. And the sympathetic system is that which was originated in the context of the earliest development of living beings in the sense that it protected them from injury, and this is what we call the reptilian part of our brain. And this responds to threat. Now, it doesn't have to be threat, real threat. It just has to be the sense of threat. And when that happens, a variety of things occur. If you're an animal on the savanna or a human on the savanna in Africa thousands of years ago, and remember, our DNA has not changed significantly in 200,000 years, if you were on the savanna in Africa and saw a lion, your blood pressure would go up, you would run, your blood would be diverted from your abdomen to your muscles, your pupils would dilate, there'd be this release of epinephrine and cortisol, and you would run, and if you survived, all of those things would immediately go down to normal. And if you didn't, well, it didn't really matter. But in the context of modern society, this reptilian part of our brain, which engages this fear mechanism, for many people is always chronically engaged on a low level. And this was never meant to be how we functioned. And in fact, evolution is a very, very slow process, while modern society changes extraordinarily rapidly, and some people would even say exponentially. So we have not created mechanisms for our evolution and our ability to respond to our modern environment. But that being said, we have evidence that we, in fact, can change our brains, this idea of neuroplasticity, whereby with certain practices, we can go from an engaged sympathetic nervous system to an engaged parasympathetic nervous system, or change the balance. When your parasympathetic nervous system is engaged, you relax, you feel a connection to others. The modern part of our brain in our frontal area that is responsible, if you will, for executive function, creativity, is engaged and allowed to function at its best. And what we see in this context is that the blood pressure decreases. These deleterious hormones such as epinephrine or cortisol levels are decreased, and our immune system functions better. And these are all very well documented events that occur when someone is compassion with intent. One of the things that both Paul and Ian commented on in regard to recognizing the suffering of others is that we have a tendency to be somewhat tribal, again, based on our evolution. But one of the components of compassion training is a recognition, one, of your own suffering, but more importantly, a recognition of our shared humanity. And there is evidence that when you clearly understand this idea that we are all, in fact, one, then this allows you to offer compassion beyond those who you know or those who you're friendly with or those in your defined group. As an example, there's research that's been done by David Destino at Northwestern that shows how if you don't identify with someone, it's hard to be compassionate. But if you make an effort to even identify a few traits that the other group, if you will, the out-group, how they're like you, it immediately starts to decrease your fear and anxiety, and you're defining those people in a negative way. And this is the power of compassion training, if you will, this ability to go beyond your defined group, which you automatically have a tendency to care for, as an example, a mother to her child, but even a parent to his relatives, but even beyond that, to your community and, in fact, the world community. And frankly, if we don't develop these capacities, the ability of our species to survive, I would suggest to you, is nil.
Ian Wilkinson, this is your bailiwick.
What James has done is he's portrayed compassion in a very rational vein in some of his comments he's just laid out. And I think he's involved in a very important work, which is trying to render the passion of compassion more rational and amenable to rational understanding. And maybe then we can proceed in a more rational way to acquire it and enact it in a progressive manner. The thought that it's evoked in me, in hearing him speak, was that there's quite a lot involved in compassion which seems to escape rationality as well. And I was thinking of the examples in history where there's been great outpourings of compassion at an unprecedented levels. If you look at the end of the 18th century, say from the 1760s onwards, a lot of modern humanitarian concerns have their roots there. And when you examine the histories of these things, it's often that people acquire intense, passionate concern for the suffering of others almost as a surprise to themselves. This is documented by Voltaire, who in the early 1760s takes up the cause of religious toleration in the case of Jean Calas, but then is surprised at himself and recognizing that he wasn't disgusted or worried about the torture that was used to exact confessions by Jean Calas initially. But this suddenly awakened to this as a concern. And then alongside any issue relating to religious tolerance, he started to be worried about the injustice of the cruelty that was meted out upon him. And I think social historians of this period time and time again document the fact that people are often suddenly overwhelmed by taken up in compassionate concerns, which are a great surprise to them, and then which then perhaps involve them in more concerted political actions to combat the causes, alleviate the effects of suffering. Now, to understand that, I think requires us to think about human beings as subject to social pressures, cultural forces, which are not easy to nail down into any lab experiment. They're highly contextual. They're often about accumulative effects of ongoing processes. And I think understanding and being able to pinpoint exactly how the dynamics of all this plays itself out is extremely difficult to pin down in any discrete manner. That's not to say I'm not intrigued by and very interested to understand how compassion can be rendered more rational.
Paul Gilbert.
Sure. I mean, I think Ian hits it on the head, really. We're a species that adapts to our environments.
and for good and for bad. And this is so we can have societies that are incredibly dissociated, where individuals literally dissociate from the suffering around them. So they go and watch, you know, tortures or people being hanged or guillotined or the Roman games or whatever it is. So we need to understand the way in which culture creates dissociation from suffering. What's interesting, I think, in the modern world is that after the Second World War, there was a very clear desire to create a better world. So in this country, for example, we built a national health service that was the envy of the world. And the idea was that we all pool together, we all work together. What's happened in the last 20 years, and I think Jeffrey Sachs's book, Prize of Civilization, is excellent on this, is that we have drifted back into competitive psychology, where actually it's not about other people, it's about what I can achieve for myself, or what my firm can achieve for myself. It's all about competitive edge. In our schools, this is what we tell our children. It's all about you need to get a competitive edge. And that, I think, is problematic, because I think, in my view, that unless we do more of what James is doing in the schools and actually helping children think more in terms of being a member of the human species and that actually we're all in this together and how can we help each other, if we move more and more towards competitive edge, then what we'll end up is more of what we got, which is people doing very bad things on the stock market and in firms and so forth because they're focused on this high sense of individuality. So I think politically, the political question at the moment is how is compassion going to play out in terms of the dynamic between individual competitiveness and coming more to pay attention to the needs of the many. After the war, we were paying attention to the needs of the many. Now we pay attention to the wishes of the few. So these are very important questions for our society.
Thank you very much for being with us here in the Scholar Circle, for sharing your research, and for this really profound discussion.
Well, thank you so much. It was wonderful.
James Doty is a clinical professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research in Education. Paul Gilbert is the head of the Mental Health Research Unit and professor of clinical psychology at the University of Derby. His books include Compassion-Focused Therapy, Distinctive Features, and The Compassionate Mind, Coping with the Challenges of Life. Ian Wilkinson is a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Kent. He is the author of Suffering, A Sociological Introduction and Anxiety in a Risk Society. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening, and if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @armoodian. See you next week.